All right. Good morning. The first case that we have on is case number 80211, Premier One Holdings, Inc. et al. Versus Edward A. Neumeyer. So this is set for a 30-minute argument, and I think we have appeal and cross-appeal in this case. So each of you can reserve some time for rebuttal, but you get a total of 15 minutes either way. So when you get up to speak, tell us how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal, but just know that the 15-minute clock keeps running. It's just the yellow light comes on, and you get a tone to warn you when you get to what you're asking for in your rebuttal time. So if you keep talking and the clock's going down, you're using up your rebuttal time. Sometimes people get confused by that. Yeah, the other thing is we have Justice Pickering in Las Vegas, and Justice Herndon and I are here in Carson City today. We are requiring mask wearing in the common areas, as you're obviously aware, and we have worn them in the common areas as well, but because we're both up here and distanced and we know we're both vaccinated, we're not wearing them up here on the bench. When you get up to speak, you can remove your mask at that time if you'd like to. If you're not comfortable doing so, of course, that's up to you, but you can remove your mask when you're speaking at the mics. Okay, with that, counsel, are you ready?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. Why don't we go ahead and start?
Good morning, Your Honor. I would like to respectfully reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure, just so that the yellow light will come on, but the clock will keep going.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. While there are multiple issues at appeal here, the key to this matter is whether or not Mr. Neumeyer holds a ownership interest in the two entities at question, Premier One Holdings and MRT. Mr. Neumeyer, however, has taken multiple actions in bad faith that show that it is inappropriate, both procedurally and substantively, to grant him the declaratory relief and the equitable relief that he is requesting. Procedurally, and it is my position that this is dispositive of the entire case, the district court originally dismissed his claims and, struck his answer to the counterclaims due to his multiple procedural violations. He failed to timely submit his pretrial memo. He failed to schedule the mandatory EDCR 2.67 conference. When the defendants, who were acting as counterplaintiffs, attempted to schedule an EDCR 2.67 conference, he failed to appear despite initially saying that he would, or at least indicating that he would through his text messages. Not only did he fail to appear at the EDCR 2.67 conference that the counterplaintiffs scheduled, he failed to take any steps to try to rectify this or provide another time. In fact, he specifically stated in one email, "I will take my chances with the judge next Monday/Tuesday. He then failed to appear at the calendar call and failed to respond.
Counsel, this is Justice Pickering from Las Vegas. What standard of review applies to your position that we should reverse the district court's grant of the motion for reconsideration?
Your Honor, motions for reconsideration are reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard.
And so I appreciate everything you said, and if you were defending the correctness of the decision to dismiss the case, that would all be germane. On the abuse of discretion standard, though, we need to focus on the legal standard that applies to the motion to reconsider or the 60B1 motion. And so to understand why it was an abuse of discretion for her to effectively reverse herself. And I'm concerned about the so-called bedrock principle that we want to try cases on the merits, and that appears to be what she hung her hat on in granting the motion to reconsider. So that would be more appropriate for me anyway in persuading me on this outcome.
Yes, Your Honor. As to addressing the standard on a motion for reconsideration, it's notable that first, a motion for reconsideration should only be granted if the original motion was actually an error. It is our position that it was in no way an error, and that Mr. Neumeier failed to show in any way that it was, or even to establish the threshold matters to get it to reconsideration. There was no change in law, there was no new evidence, and there was no clear error. There was no error at all by the district court. However, to address the matters of the substantive issues, at least as to the substantive issues regarding the declaratory and equitable relief that was given to Mr. Neumeier, the court erred in that. Mr. Neumeier had unclean hands. He repeatedly and willfully took improper actions. Among other things, even setting aside his procedural violations during the litigation, prior to the litigation, he deliberately and knowingly accessed files belonging to the entities after he no longer had any justifiable reason to do so or authority to do so, and he destroyed many of those files. Now, the district court found that the award for damages on that was nominal, literally $1. However, the district court did note that this was an abuse of his position, that it was an improper access, and it also noted that he was an untrustworthy witness. This by itself would show that he has unclean hands and that any equitable relief granted to him would have been improper. Now, looking at the Las Vegas...
Doesn't unclean hands, as a defense in this context, have to relate to the actual issue that's the relief being sought? In other words, it's not just, well, you're a bad person out there in the world, so you can never get equitable relief. It's the equitable relief that was granted, I guess, at what you're challenging is the finding that he had an interest in the two companies. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so then... how does his accessing the Dropbox, odious as it may be, how does him doing that after the breakup, if you will, of the relationship, how does that affect whether he is entitled to an interest in the companies or not?
Well, Your Honor, that was not his only improper action, as we'll get to in a moment, but as to how it ties in, he had access in the first place, or at least indirectly had the ability to get access, which is what he ultimately used, because he was an employee of the company. And it is his contention, in fact, it was the finding of the district court, that at that time he was an owner of the company. His ownership put him in a position of trust, at least theoretically, if the district court was right that he had it, and he asserts that he did. He violated that trust. Even if, hypothetically, he had an ownership interest prior to that, this would have been a proper, stripping him of that ownership interest would have been a proper response to his direct violation of the company's trust, destruction of their data. And as to the other ways he's violated it, he directly told the companies that he needed an ownership interest to represent them. Or more specifically, he needed an ownership interest to be able to go before the Nevada State Bar Association and ask for limited permission to practice in Nevada. This is a misstatement of law. Now, there was some debate as
to... You say that, sir, you object to that, and there may well be an issue of law with respect to the impropriety of that representation to your client. But I don't see in the briefs a citation to the SCRs, and perhaps I just missed it, or to case law on whether that was or was not true under the rules governing limited admission. Can you refer us to that?
Your Honor, it is under SCR 49. I'm afraid I do not recall precisely where in the briefs off the top of my head that was mentioned. It was discussed very briefly in the briefing that this was an incorrect statement of law. But more than that, Mr. Neumeier made that representation in hopes of gaining ownership interest in the companies. Now, whether he did this in good faith or not was not formally decided at trial, but the fact that he made the representation and that the entities acted upon that shows that he was acting improperly, even if hypothetically he genuinely believed his statements.
But none of the officers of Premier One even testified at trial, so they didn't testify that that was the basis for giving him the interest, right?
Your Honor, none of the actual officers, neither the president nor the secretary, none of those appeared at trial. That is correct. However, Premier One testified through its official representative, Ms. Candace Carducci. Ms. Carducci is their paralegal and also their official custodian of records. She was also present for some of the conversations and was directly told, as she testified, by Mr. Neumeier that he needed this ownership interest. Furthermore, there are emails supporting it. While they don't directly state that, he's saying he needs these documents in order, in the emails, to be clear. He needs these documents in order to present them to the Nevada State Bar Association.
He says that in the emails that were introduced. Is that what you just said?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Now, to be clear, he does not directly state in those emails that it was a requirement for him to practice. That was done verbally. However, he does say in the emails that he needs them to present them to the Nevada State Bar, that he needs them promptly for that purpose, and that supports the testimony provided by Ms. Carducci.
Okay.
Moreover, Your Honors, even if...
But again, the district court found that he had an ownership interest, and there is some documentary evidence to support that. And her findings discredit, really, both sides' oral presentations at trial. We have to view this through the lens of whether her findings are clearly erroneous. And so I appreciate your position, but I'm not sure that there's such a one-way street on the evidence that she didn't have anything to support her finding that he had a part ownership.
That is correct, Your Honor. At least as to MRT, it is true that there were documentation supporting it. There were documents for Premier One that indirectly support it. However, regarding Premier One specifically, the crucial document, the assignment of the stocks, was not signed, and Mr. Neumeier was aware of this. The court's decision was based on promissory estoppel in the documentary evidence. However, at least as to Premier One, the crucial document was not signed, and Mr. Neumeier could not have relied upon it because he knew it was not signed, and he knew that, as a lawyer, the legal significance of that.
Yeah, but, I mean, K-1s were issued. I mean, that's got some legal effect, does it not?
It does, Your Honor, and that is relevant evidence. However, when the finding is based upon promissory estoppel, there needs to be reliance and there needs to be a lack of awareness on the part of the party claiming promissory estoppel. Mr. Neumeier was aware that the crucial document was not signed. As a lawyer, he was aware of the legal significance of that. And more than that, there is no sign at any time that he relied upon any indication that he was going to be made an owner. He did not pay for his ownership. He did not invest in the entities. He did not take actions that would have only been taken by an owner and not by an employee. In no way did he rely on this.
Do you want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. All right.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Tracy DeFlippo, and I represent Edward Neumeier as the respondent cross-appellant. First, the issue that appellants raised was the motion for reconsideration. They are looking at the wrong standard. They're looking under a NRCP 59E. This is an NRCP 60B, where you're looking at excusable neglect and the Yoakum factors.
Can I interrupt you on that?
Correct.
Yes. I recognize you weren't involved down below, but part of my concern with the lack of findings by the court in any written order is that we don't really know exactly what basis she decided that on. It appears the parties both seem to be talking about Rule 60B. But if it wasn't a final order, if it was interlocutory, was Rule 60 really the right standard to apply to deciding that motion?
That's an excellent point, Your Honor. I would point out that this court has said in previous case law that if there is either impliedly or expressly you reference NRCP 60B or the Yoakum factors, you review it under that standard. You are correct. There is no minute. There's only a minute order. We pointed out in our briefing that there was no official order. In the reply, they attached the transcript. But this court, under Russ v. Clark County School District, 103 Nevada 686, an oral pronouncement, even a minute order, has no effect for any purpose. So that this issue should be summarily dismissed because they can't do anything with it. There's no order that was been entered.
The case went to trial, so I think we can conclude there was reconsideration of the dismissal.
That is correct, Your Honor. So if we want to, but then I think then we look to the pleadings below, and Mr. Neumeier did reference the Yoakum factors, which would be a 60B reference, and the court did find that the transcript that they did produce supports that the court said there was excusable neglect. So that is an oral pronouncement, but that is a finding in the transcript.
And so maybe this is the kind of ticky-tack stuff that, but this is what we look at. So when the court first had granted relief as against your client, she defaulted your client as to the counterclaims, and dismissed his affirmative claims, but there was still to be a prove-up hearing as to the counterclaims, right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay. So then with that posture, I guess I'm circling back to Justice Herndon's question, which was, is 60B the appropriate path to seek reconsideration at that time, because 60B addresses review or reconsideration of a final judgment, as opposed to an EDCR, I forgot which rule number, the EDCR reconsideration motion of an interlocutory order. Do you understand what I'm saying? If it seems like if there's still a piece left of the case, it's not a final judgment, so what rule is it being reconsidered under?
Well, I understand the confusion here, and I think with respect to, you look under the EDCR, that's the basis that he did it, but you have to have a standard of how you're reviewing that. And the standard under the Yoakum factors are the excusable neglect, which references 60B. The 59E is a motion to reconsider because you have new evidence or there was something that you're committing the error, versus a 60B, you're looking at excusable neglect. And in this case, that's what the court was looking at, was the excusable neglect. So you look under those Yoakum factors as to whether there was excusable neglect, you know, lack of the procedural, good faith, intent to delay. Those are the factors that the court was looking at.
So it seems like the court, when it found excusable neglect, was focused on the issues regarding your client's, error in calendaring for the calendar call, thinking it was the afternoon rather than the morning, and then the issues apparently with his phone that day. And I guess it seems like she didn't directly address some of the other previous issues, the failure to have the 2.67 conference, et cetera, that your opposing counsel has relied on. I guess, does that matter?
That's the problem of not having an order, Your Honor. And she did not make specific findings as to that in the trial and the transcript of the hearing, but she did ask for Mr. Neumeier to address those issues, and he did address them at the hearing as to explaining why he didn't do the pretrial memo and the EDCR 2.67 conference to go over the trial exhibits. He admitted he wasn't prepared. He was confused as to the status of the case with respect to they had settlement discussions. He, for some reason, he thought that there was a stay of the case. He says he had a conversation with counsel as to continuing. They didn't file a counterclaim to after discovery. There were several things that confused
them. But the court didn't, like, so yes, he raised all of those things.
Right.
The court ended up reconsidering to the extent of resetting the trial, and so your client wasn't defaulted, but didn't reopen discovery, still was saying, look, I was on a trial track. You should have been on a trial track, and now we're going to trial next month. Let's go. So I guess, as you said, it's not clear that she was necessarily sympathetic to all of those things that your client raised, except the fact that, okay, I understand why he wasn't present for the calendar call.
And I think, as Justice Pickering had mentioned in one of her questions as to appellants as the linchpin, it seemed in the trial and the hearing transcript, that the court was focused on hearing the case on the merits, which is the policy of Nevada. And this court in the Yoakum had acknowledged precedent that, you know, it's more likely that the appellate court will uphold a decision to set aside a dismissal versus to refusal to do so because we want to hear cases on the merits. And that appeared to maybe, in addition to his calendaring mistake and excusable neglect, to hear the case on the merits, and that appeared to be with the court.
So if this is under Rule 60B, we have held that the court has to address the Yoakum factors, and if the court didn't hear, do we need to remand it to the court to make those findings?
I don't think so, because I think that the court did find specifically the excusable neglect and did ask him with respect to those other issues as to why he didn't file the pretrial memo and the EDCR 2.67. He specifically addressed those, and appellants had the opportunity to present an order to the court to make those findings. They have the burden, and they didn't do that. So I think it should just be summarily
dismissed. Did the appellants ever ask the district court to make specific findings on the reconsideration motion?
Your Honor, I wasn't there below, but with respect to looking at the hearing transcript, there was nothing in the hearing transcript where they would ask that. No, Your Honor.
And there's nothing in the written record that is reflected in the docket sheet. I appreciate you were not counsel below, but I didn't see anything where the lawyers on your colleagues across the aisle said, wait, you need to have specific findings. Your motion, your order dismissing this effectively and defaulting Mr. Neumeier was righteous, and he didn't make the required showing to get relief. And we need specific findings because we want to appeal it. There was none of that dialogue in district court. Is that right?
That is correct.
That you've seen.
That I've seen. I did not see any of that. I paved through all of the documents, and I did not see anything like that, Your Honor. The next issue that the appellants raised were the unclean hands, and the district court clearly rejected that affirmative defense. This court, you know, looks at whether substantial evidence supports the district court's finding, doesn't weigh the evidence. As, you know, the justices you recognized during appellant's argument, there was documentary evidence to support that he had an ownership interest in these entities 4 months prior to submission of that SCR 49.10 application. Even if he made that alleged statement with respect to, you know, I need to be in-house counsel and so I need an ownership interest. The annual list of directors for Premier was filed in June of 2015. The operating agreement for MRT was in June or July of 2015. The SRC application wasn't even done until September of 2015. I'm sorry, I keep saying 14, it's 15.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. This is awkward. But what do we make of the fact that here is a lawyer who is working as a lawyer for an entity, and he advises them that he needs to have an ownership interest in the entity, That on its face kind of looks like a conflict under our rules of professional responsibility. And I don't see anything where he advised the client that they should get outside opinion on that or anything else. I mean, is there an issue there that was litigated in district court, or am I just raising an outsider's question?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I think you're raising an outsider's question. I looked through it. None of that was addressed to the district court below that I could find in the record that was presented to this court as to that issue. None of it was presented at trial. I don't see it in any of the pleadings with respect to arguments to the court.
Does Mr. Neumeier, what is his testimony on that? I mean, does he say, yes, I told them that, or does he deny that he told them that?
He denied it, Your Honor.
Okay.
He denied saying that, and the only person that testified at trial was Ms. Carducci, and they claim in their pleadings that she was a corporate representative, but the court made a specific finding that she was a legal secretary, and she was only testifying as the custodian of records. They didn't preside any evidence from any of their officers or anybody that this statement was made to them and that they relied on this statement. The documentary evidence showed that he had an ownership interest. There's substantial evidence that support that he has an ownership interest. Yes, they raised the stock certificate. It wasn't signed by it didn't have the signature of the legal secretary, but it had a signature of the president. And that's, again, conflicting evidence which the court weighs. The court, looked at, there's K-1s that were filed. There was documentation that was filed to the Secretary of State. Mr. Neumeier testified he relied on those documents to think that he had an ownership interest.
You want to reserve any time? It's up to you.
No, Your Honor. I'm going to go right into the cross-claim. I'm going to quickly just address that they might address it on their reply here, but there was an appointment of a receiver, that's, again, abuse of discretion standard. The district court found that they were insolvent, that they made specific findings that was unrebutted, that they weren't paying their bills, they were insolvent. They did post-briefing, and yes, appellants attached a declaration from the Michael Ring, the president, premier, and a member at MRT to say we're not insolvent, and some financials from the accountant, but that evidence wasn't presented at trial, and that is evidence that could have been presented at trial, and they didn't do it. So I think the court just rejected that, because the only issue on the post-trial with respect to the receiver was, am I going to dissolve them or appoint a receiver? And just to let you guys know, the court has actually granted them their motion to dissolve. So the entities have been dissolved.
Oh.
And that has just been recent.
So, okay.
I have a question on that then, because I thought that the record showed that the court had stayed the receivership, but that life has moved on while this case has been pending here.
Your Honor, on behalf of Mr. Neumeier, we filed a motion in order to show cause why they should not be held to return to terminate the stay and return the cost bond, and they shouldn't be held in contempt because they actually dissolved without telling the court, and there were status checks, and they never told the court. The court actually made a finding of contempt and granted us attorney's fees as to the filing of that, did not terminate the stay, but asked them, they said she allowed them to file a motion to dissolve after the fact,
okay,
and granted that. So that's kind of where that happened. That's just been recent in a few months.
So while the order granting receivership was stayed pending appeal, the companies went ahead and dissolved themselves?
Yes, in violation of the stay, which the court found.
Okay.
I do want to go right.
I have one more. I'm sorry.
No
I
worries.
Have one more question to confirm. The briefing talks about the impropriety of adding counterclaims when the appellants filed an answer to the second amended complaint and then added counterclaims, and that those were untimely and without leave and therefore should not be considered. I don't think it's of much practical consequence, but you argue about it on appeal, and I could not find anything in the record that showed that Mr. Neumeier in district court challenged the addition of those counterclaims other than by saying he needed discovery on them. In other words, he didn't move to dismiss them or strike them. Or did he? I wanted to confirm one way or the other with you.
That is correct, Your Honor, and we're not making the argument as to the that the court should not have allowed that. We're making it in a connection with respect to not granting the motion to reopen the discovery. So it's in connection as part of that reason, but not as a separate issue.
Thank you.
Sorry, so I'm going to go over time here just for a second.
I had a question as well.
Okay. So the only relief, I think, granted on the counterclaims was the $1 on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Is that accurate?
Yes, Your Honor. There's only a nominal, but there was no evidence as to right of damages.
Sure. No, I understand there is an argument as to that, but so if we were to agree with your argument about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, then there would be no relief at all being granted on the counterclaims.
Your Honor, that does make, if you grant us on the CFAA, then there's no reason to reopen discovery because we're only asking as to limited as to the counterclaim.
Perfect. That was my question.
That was kind of a segue into my question as well. I mean, it seems like Judge Gonzalez's order reflects that I'm not going to address the statute of limitations on the CFAA because there's no evidence of damages. She says that in a footnote. And then on the next page, she says I'm awarding nominal damages on the CFAA claim. So it would appear that she just didn't address at all, either orally on the record or in the written order, the statute of limitations issue with that claim?
That is correct. She didn't address she just put it in a footnote in her findings that she was not going to address that issue, even though that clearly was an issue that was raised. And she did make a specific finding that there was no evidence presented as to the damages right. as a result of the conduct, which under the CFA, you have to at least show $5,000 in damages, but there's that.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, rebuttal, and let's give you an extra minute given the overtime here.
There were several very well-raised points there. To begin with, if I might clarify regarding the dissolution, the companies more accurately have begun the dissolution process. They have not and cannot completely dissolve until all pending litigation, including but not limited to this one, is resolved, and they are aware of that. They will be prepared to pay out any profits, which are at this point unknown, if and when they fully dissolve. Now, more substantively
counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that happened while after the court has granted a receivership but stayed that pending appeal of whether it's appropriate to order a receiver or not. Did somebody think maybe we should ask the court about this?
Your Honor, I do not know. I know that they consulted with legal counsel. However, it was not me. They also consulted with their accountant, but that was also not me. I came in on that point afterwards.
And it sounds like the district court is dealing with that, so that may be unfair. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, regarding the receivership, it was alleged that there was unrebutted evidence that they were insolvent. That is an improper burden shifting. The receivership...
Go ahead.
Let me back up to be more clear. It was alleged that there was unrebutted evidence. However, there was no evidence placed onto the record at trial to show that they were insolvent under the traditional definition, other than Mr. Neumeier's disputed bills, which were ultimately not granted by the district court. There was no evidence that there were bills that were not being timely paid or that they were otherwise insolvent under traditional definitions of that word. It is Mr. Neumeier's burden as the person asking to not only show that it's appropriate because they are insolvent, which he did not demonstrate, but also that a receivership is an appropriate remedy. This court in other situations has found that it is a harsh result, and in particular that it should only be that it should rarely be granted when the persons or entities who have contributed the majority of the capital are objecting to it. In this case, the individuals that have contributed capital to the entities are objecting to the appointment of receivership. Mr. Neumeier, even assuming he retains an ownership interest, did not contribute capital, has not shown that he contributed capital. Under that situation, the granting of receivership was inappropriate, even if Mr. Neumeier has an ownership interest. And of course, if it is ultimately found that he does not have an ownership interest, then the question is moot, since it requires an ownership interest for someone other than under limited circumstances a creditor to ask for a receivership in the first place.
Well, if the, I'm just thinking out loud here, but if the companies are dissolved, and I realize that that's a process, not an, a one-moment act, but is the receivership moot at that point?
No, Your Honor. The as you said, it is a process, and under these particular circumstances, it is likely to be a lengthy process. These entities are primarily in the business of holding and managing properties, many of which were purchased at HOA foreclosures. There is ongoing litigation regarding some of those, and it may be some period before that is fully resolved and dissolution can be complete. Your Honor, regarding the question of whether Ms. Carducci was an appropriate witness, and it should be acknowledged that, as was pointed out, the district court essentially found all the verbal testimony to be questionable, but she was their selected corporate representative. I see I'm out of time.
You can finish your thought if you want.
Thank you, Your Honor. She was their selected corporate representative. She was their custodian of records, which is in many cases, especially document-based cases as this one, the best person to put forward. And she was the person most knowledgeable regarding the issues that they thought would be relevant. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you very much. We will take this matter under